You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
I've met some, what's the word? It's on the tip of my tongue. Oh, right. I have met some kinky motherfuckers. That's the word I was looking for there, motherfuckers. Thank you, Representative Rashida Tlaib, for helping me out. Anyway, I have met some kinky motherfuckers in my time. I've talked to some on this show. I've hooked up with a few. I may have even married one. I like kinky motherfuckers. Usually. But I have never met a kinkier or less likable motherfucker than the kinky and repulsive motherfucker behind biblical gender roles. Now, I'd like to think no one reads the website BGR, not to be confused with the Supreme Court Justice RBG, just as I'd like to think no one reads the Wall Street Journal's op-ed page. But both, sadly, have readers. There's actually a lively discussion under the particular BGR post a listener directed me to. But before we go any further, I'm going to issue a rare content warning, heads up for misogyny, sexual violence, and Bible citations. So, after reading Why a Wife Should Endure Painful Sex with Her Husband at BGR, I hoped it was a parody site, The Onion, now with Leviticus, but nope, BGR appears to be on the up and up. And in this 3,200-word article, the author argues, he makes the case for Christian wives enduring pain during sex, enduring it and covering it up so as not to needlessly alarm the Christian husband on top of them, causing them pain during sex. The argument goes like this. God created man in his image to bring glory to God, because really, what's more glorious than some pissing, shitting, farting primate? God also created woman, but God created woman for man, not man for woman. Take it from the dudes who wrote the Bible. And according to those same dudes, sex is the natural use of the woman by the man. And a woman's desire for sex was not given to her for her own sake, but rather for the sake of her husband. And finally, in the author's own words, all Christians, both men and women, are called upon to emulate Christ's endurance in the face of suffering and pain. All Christians, but, you know, of course, lady Christians in particular. The author of this post has a chapter and verse citation for each of these points because, of course, he does. The Bible has been used to justify and support everything from slavery to abolition, from killing your children to loving your children, from rich people paying their fucking taxes to rich people buying politicians who will slash their taxes, from condemning Bill Clinton's adultery to excusing Donald Trump's adultery. As we've seen time and time again over the centuries, the good book is only as good as the person reading it or citing it. Now, in fairness, the author does throw the ladies a bone being the last thing a woman might want to see after enduring painful sex with her husband, but a bone is thrown. A Christian man should not have sex with a woman immediately after childbirth or when she has the flu. And a Christian woman is allowed to consult with her Christian doctor about painful intercourse. But if her Christian doctor tells her that nothing can be done, quote, the answer is clear, even if it's not easy. A wife who suffers from chronic and untreatable painful intercourse must find the strength to endure such pain and not only endure it, but hide it as much as possible from her husband and do her best to fulfill the one purpose for which God designed her, and that is the sexual pleasure of her husband. The author of Why a Wife Should Endure Painful Sex with Her Husband opens by condemning sadism and sadists, because it's not okay to have painful sex with someone who might actually enjoy having painful sex with you. It's only okay to inflict painful sex on some poor woman who doesn't enjoy it because Leviticus, Corinthians, Romans, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Say what you like about all the honest sadists out there with ads on kink and fetish websites and sometimes calls here on the Savage Lovecast. At least they're looking for self-aware, self-actualized masochists, for people who enjoy a certain amount or certain kind of pain during sex. And these sadists, often portrayed as monsters on crime procedurals, they're willing to negotiate about limits and safe words and even go get a bottom of a little ice cream after a particularly intense scene. Good and decent sadists don't manipulate their partners with Bronze Age bullshit about magic sky friends threatening them with damnation and eternal suffering if they don't suck it up or lay there and endure it here on Earth. Good and decent sadists don't do that for the same reason good and decent Christians don't do that, because it's wrong. After reading all the way through why a wife should endure painful sex with her husband, I had to click on the About section because I really wanted to know more about the website and the author. Larry Solomon, not his real name, is passionate about theology, history, human nature, and computers. He works in IT. He taught Sunday school. The About Me section goes on and on and on. Larry is white, a white male in his 40s, attended a Christian high school, has various technical certificates, and does not write under his own name, he says, for the same reason Christ hid himself from the Jews. I'm no biblical scholar myself, but I kind of remember, recall, believe that Christ himself was a Jew. Anyway, you have to endure the pain of reading all the way to the end of the About Me section before you get to this. Well, first, before we get to this, if you're standing, please sit. If you're driving, please pull over. If you're sucking a dick, what comes next could transform that dick into a choking hazard, so please put the dick down. Everybody ready? Okay. At the end of the About Me section, you will find this. I was divorced from my first wife after she committed adultery. Yup. The wife of the man behind articles like Why a Wife Should Endure Painful Sex with Her Husband and its companion piece, How a Husband Can Enjoy Sex That Causes His Wife Pain, as well as other epic biblical citation specced articles like Why Husbands Are Not Accountable to Their Wives and Why God Wants You to Stay in an Abusive Relationship, that man's wife decided after who knows how many shitty, painful sexual encounters, not to mention who knows how many shitty, painful conversations, she decided to go fuck someone else. And after fucking that someone else, she decided to divorce Larry's sorry ass. That's what I was divorced means. Larry writes, I was divorced. That means he didn't divorce her. His first wife divorced him. And who can blame her? Jesus forgave the woman taken in adultery. Taken in adultery is Bible speak for caught in the act. Telling the angry mob that wanted to stone that woman to death, the angry mob of men outside the Jewish temple where Jesus was hiding from the Jews that day, he told them that the man without sin should cast the first stone, and then told the woman taken in adultery to go home and sin no more. John 7:53-8:11. I'm guessing Jesus would have done the same for Larry's wife. Told the mob and Larry to fuck off, and then given Larry's wife the name of a nice, single, Jewish divorce lawyer, along with his blessing to keep fucking guys better than Larry at sex and better than Larry at Christianity, too. Okay, we've got a great show for you today, a great micro edition, the free edition of Savage Lovecast, and the subscription edition of the Savage Lovecast, which you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com. Twice as long and no ads is also pretty great. Lots of greatness coming up for you today on the Savage Lovecast. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Everlane, luxury basic clothing and accessories made at ethical factories without those retail markups. For free shipping and to support the Lovecast, go to everlane.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Bull and Branch, luxury, affordable, fair trade certified sheets. Get $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping by going to bullandbranch.com and entering Savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a late 20s woman on the West Coast. I'm dating a wonderful, really lovely, smart, generous, GGG, non-binary person who's in an open relationship. It's all really cool. I'm stoked about everything that's going on. The one thing is that they have a Hitler mustache. I don't ever want to be a person who tells somebody what to do with their body, and particularly their body hair, but I hate it. I don't like it. I don't like it. I'm Jewish. They're not Jewish. It really weirds me out. I want them to do, like, whatever they want with their body, but I am, like, inviting them to come with me to a Hanukkah party. Weird. It's weird. Like, I feel like I have to warn my friends and, like, put an asterisk and be like, they're not a Nazi. This person says that they always liked the look, and if we're not allowed to have that mustache anymore at all, if no one's allowed to have it anymore, then Hitler wins. I don't know. What do I do? What can I do? What is reasonable for me to do or say in this situation?
Thank you for jumping on the phone. I had to talk to you one-on-one.
Okay.
And I want to open with this. Before we get to anything else, Hitler won. The mustache. Lost the war, lost France and Poland, and ultimately his shitty, mean, miserable life. But he won the mustache and the swastika and the goose step and the Hitler salute. He won all of those. And there's no taking those back from Hitler. So I'm actually calling you to ask you how the Hanukkah party went with the Hitler mustache person friend.
Well, it went fine. What I've started to notice is that very few people, except for the few bold people, say anything in the moment. It's only after where I'm like, oh, so I'm like seeing this person. And they're like, oh, yeah, the mustache guy. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that guy, you know. So no one, I mean, a couple people have said something in the moment, but it's always after the fact.
And after the fact, did they come up to you and say, are you fucking crazy? Why are you dating this lunatic?
No, I mean, like, when you talk to this person for all of 30 seconds, like, it doesn't, you don't think that they're a Nazi or, like, a fascist or a racist. So I don't know if it's, like, they're trying to, like, you know, challenge people's assumptions or something, but it doesn't feel...
It reminds me of the anti-racist skinheads from the 80s and 90s mm-hmm. who dressed up like racist, fascist skinheads from 30 years ago, and then would like take such offense that you might think that they were fascists, even though they were running around dressed up exactly like fucking fascist, violent, racist skinhead gang members.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I think it's a little bit like that. It's like, how could you possibly think this of me?
You're wearing Hitler's fucking mustache.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's toxic. It's just like the people who go, well, but the swastika is this ancient Indian symbol that means infinity and life and joy and whatever the else the fuck. So I got it tattooed on my forehead. How dare you think that I'm implying that there's anything Nazi about the swastika I have tattooed on my fucking forehead?
That's funny that you bring that up, because they brought up the other swastika too.
Oh, for fuck's sake. It's a kind of pedantic game playing where someone, you know, it's like, well, no, I don't. You have the problem. You're the one who's thinking Hitler when you see this mustache or the swastika or the fact that I'm goose stepping around at your Hanukkah party. You're the one with the party. The problem, you know, the Prussians were goose stepping before the Nazis. Like that kind of pedantic game playing horseshit.
Yeah,
you shouldn't put up with it. Hitler won the mustache. That's it. Hitler won the mustache. Lost the fucking war. Won the fucking mustache, and it's his for, it's just for the same reason you go to Germany. You don't meet kids named Adolf. I go to Germany and Austria a lot. I have friends there, and I never meet a 20-year-old named Adolf or a 30-year-old named Adolf or a 40-year-old named Adolf.
Like, put a pin in that name and like forget about it. It's over.
Yeah.
But here's my question is like, this person really or seems to believe that this is like the most flattering facial hair situation on them.
No.
I disagree.
No, it is not the most flattering facial hair situation on anyone, because there's not a person on the planet who looks at that mustache and doesn't think fan of Adolf Hitler's.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
What do I do? So what do I do?
You can't tell someone else what to do with their body. You can't tell someone else what to do with their facial hair, but they can't tell you what to do with your body. Or your face.
Do you think I should like withhold, like be like, I don't want to do this anymore because
I can't, I can't date you. I can't date you while you're playing this game. I can't date a person who engages in such sophistry and antagonizes people and then sits there pretending that butter won't melt in his ass. This is antagonizing people.
Okay.
What you're doing is risible or risable. I never know how to say that word. I should look it up. Risible, risible. What you're doing is provocative, and then you're pretending that everybody else is the one with the problem or that they're the ones provoking you by suggesting there's something Hitler-y about your fucking Hitler mustache.
Oh, man. It's just so weird. It's so weird.
It's not an exact comparison, but my husband, anybody who follows him on Instagram, every once in a while he has a mustache.
I do.
Okay, every once in a while he has a mustache.
Yeah.
It's when I'm out of town. Because he cannot have a mustache when I have to look at his face. And he has made the like, I should be able, it's my face and you shouldn't be able to tell me what to do with it. And I'm like, all right, I'm not telling you what to do with your face. But you can't tell me what to do with my face, and my face is not touching your face while that thing is on your lip. And
oh,
so,
man.
And so, okay, it's a stalemate. I'm not telling you what to do with your face, but I'm not fucking kissing you. I'm not even going to look at you. I can't turn my face toward your face when you have that porn stash.
Yeah.
And you should be able to say to him, I am not telling you you can't have that mustache, but I am telling you you can't have me while you have that mustache.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make a choice mm-hmm. between the Hitler stash or the girlfriend.
Oh, my God. It's so silly. Okay.
But it's,
all right.
You know, in a way, it's not silly, particularly in this cultural, in this climate right now, when we have Richard Spencer, when we have Nazis
yeah.
running around, running cars into groups of anti-fascist protesters and killing people. And we have.
Yeah. Like, why would you want to beg the question at all?
At this moment, you walking yeah. around with that mustache is making people fear. For their safety,
right.
fear for their country, fear for the direction in which we are headed. This is not a moment where you can play games and,
yeah.
and put yourself out there in public in such a way that people think you're with Richard Spencer. You're making people feel unsafe
right.
and uncomfortable and threatened. And it's assholery. It's assholery dressed
yeah.
up in this, like, oh, we can't let Hitler win. It's assholery dressed up in this, what? I don't know what you're talking about. It's just a mustache. No, it is not just a mustache, just like it's not just a swastika. Like, it's not just,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the Romans saluted in this way. Fuck you. No. The Nazis
yeah.
won the Hitler salute. That's why it's called the Hitler salute. And the Nazis won the goose step and the mustache and the swastika. And that's all they fucking won.
Sure.
And you know what?
Yeah.
You can't let him win this. He
okay.
has to pay the price. Or I'm sorry, they have to pay the price.
He uses both. You're not doing anything wrong.
Okay, good. I'm not going to get glittered the next time I leave the house. They have to
yeah.
pay the price, which is, yeah, you can wear a fucking Hitler mustache. You're not going to get invited to a lot of Hanukkah parties, though. And I'm shocked that you took him to the one.
I was like, would you want to come to this Hanukkah party? He said yes. And then I was like, oh my God, your mustache. And like, we laughed about it and then like didn't talk about it.
And then you took him?
Yeah. And then he came and he like hit it off with all his friends. I mean, you know, it was like, but it's just fucking weird. It's a weird choice.
Yeah. There are 7 billion other human beings on the planet. 3.5 billion
yeah.
of them are,
yeah.
you know, penis havers. And you have many to choose from who don't have Hitler mustaches and aren't going to play these kind of pedantic games.
Yeah, I hear you.
So end it. And maybe, you know, maybe you threatening to end it will be the leverage and the excuse he needs to reluctantly shave that fucking Hitler mustache off his goddamn upper lip.
It's so weird. It's weird to kiss. It's very weird.
That was my other question for you. You're a nice Jewish lady. You're going to have sex with this person. What goes through your mind when you like look down between your legs, they're eating your pussy, and then that face comes up and there's that soaking wet Hitler mustache? How can
yeah.
you maintain your, how do you
yeah,
not like become the Sahara at that moment?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's super attractive, like in every other way. And like really good at sex. Like really very, very good.
He would
at sex.
Have to be really good at sex to compensate for
yeah.
the soaking wet pussy juice
yeah.
infused Hitler mustache between your legs.
Yeah.
My vagina, if I had one, would close up at that moment permanently.
Mm-hmm.
I would roll a stone in mm-hmm. front of it like Jesus's tomb.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
This was very helpful.
I hope so. I hope it was clarifying and good luck.
It was. I'm glad that you had such a strong reaction.
Nice person, good sex. Hopefully the good sense to look at you and think, yeah, worth it to keep her in my life. I'm going to get rid of the fucking Hitler mustache. That's how I hope this
yeah.
plays out.
Thank you. I love your show. Really, really do.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Hi, Dan. This is a 30-year-old female calling from New York. I have a quick question for you. I listen to your podcast a lot, and although I think I know the answer, I think it's best to have another perspective. So I've just recently broken up from a 7-year relationship. I moved out, got my own place, and I've been living solo for 10 months now. I haven't been dating. I haven't been talking to anyone. I haven't been entertaining anything. I'm literally workaholic. And just recently, there was a corporate holiday party that I had went to, And basically everyone kind of got shit-faced, right? Everyone's feelings are all over the place or whatever. And it ends up being that one of my coworkers told me that they had feelings for me, like professing since the moment I met you, I've seen this and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to see if we can work things out, blah, blah, blah. This coworker is actually a woman. And ever since we had that conversation, haven't stopped thinking about her. It's really kind of crazy. I feel like I've become this obsessive stalker kind of person, whereas, you know, we've been talking all the time, texting, messaging a lot, especially in the past few weeks. And I say constant, I mean, it's all the time. And just recently, it stopped. Now, it's only been 2 weeks, so I know I'm just like really, really hyper energy, whatever the case is, but I think it stopped because I feel like I might have been too eager or have come off a little bit too aggressive. Like our messaging went from intimate to about my past and how I grew up. And I think the biggest thing was the sexting part, which kind of threw me off because I've never done that with any guy before. Not even, you know, I've done it with exes or whatever in relationships, but I haven't expressed myself sexually to someone so quick. And the messaging hasn't ceased completely, but it's definitely not the same. And I don't know how to process these feelings. I'm sitting here looking at my phone, wondering when she's going to text me again. I know when she's getting off of work. I know, you know, where she lives. It's crazy. I've known her for years. So I just need your help on this because I never felt this way for anyone, and let alone a woman, which is pretty scary. As far as I know, I'm heterosexual, and this person has awoken something in me, and I don't know what to do.
I don't think we can demand closure from another human being. Closure is something that we do ourselves. We shut those doors. But we can ask for clarity. We can ask for information. You've noticed what you've noticed. Things have slowed. Things have cooled. And your assumption is that maybe you came on too strong. Well, you told me about that. You told all of us about that. You can tell her about that. This has all been going on during the holidays. All of this crazy texting, all of this crazy sexting. Your entire relationship after this woman confessed that she had feelings for you was really funneled and processed and crammed through your phones. And it coincided with busy, stressful holiday time. This could just be a coincidence. You could be misreading the fact that she hasn't been as available to you in the last couple of weeks over the holidays as she was initially as she cooled on you. And it could be that she's just been really stressed out and super busy with holiday shit and family shit and hasn't had as much time to devote to sexting. Or it could be that after getting out of this 7-year relationship and being celibate and on your own for 10 months, you came on a little strong. You got a little overeager and perhaps you spooked her. And if she says that to you, you can then respond with, yeah, sorry about that. It's been 10 months since I got laid. I probably did come on a little too strong. I'm going to slow my roll. I'm going to show you that I have the emotional maturity and dexterity to hear that from you and not freak out and not get angry and adjust my behavior, which is a skill that we want to see in people that we're contemplating dating or committing to. So you can demonstrate that to her in that moment. And the skill you want to see from her, what you want to see from someone you're considering dating, is that they can give you constructive feedback. And then when you make an adjustment, appreciate that you were able to make that adjustment and to reengage with you. And if she's not willing to do that, if she has some sort of one strike, you're out policy, that's not somebody that you would want to get involved with anyway. So you're going to have a conversation with her about what's going on right now without getting too processy about it. And then you're going to show her through how you respond to the feedback that you get from her that you're someone she might want to think about dating and reengaging with. And she's going to show you through giving you this feedback and being receptive to this adjustment that you're able to make that she's someone that you might want to think about dating. And if she doesn't show you that or you don't show her that, then you can just move the fuck on. And this was just a crush that burnt out. That also is a thing that sometimes happens. And I want to pivot here to just a general point about connections that we make online. When a dating app or a hookup app brings you together, or you meet somebody and you exchange your phone numbers and then you engage in a lot of DMing and texting and sexting, that can burn up and burn through a lot of erotic and sexual energy. You can wear that out. that can burn up and burn out the erotic energy that attracted you to each other in the first place. You want to, you know, flirt a little bit, maybe sext a little bit, but then you want to get together. You don't want all of the energy, all of the erotic energy to be plowed into your phone. You want to plow some of that into each other in real life, in real time. And phones have a way of disinhibiting us. And sometimes when we're on our devices, we're a little bit more forward than we would be in person, because it is, even if we're sexting or texting with somebody that we know, it is kind of anonymous. It is a faceless form of communication. And you can get out over your skis emotionally, erotically, sexually, and that can put somebody off. Or you can get out over your skis emotionally, erotically, socially, and lose interest, or cause them to lose interest because they feel like they've explored everything they could possibly explore with you erotically without ever having to be in your presence. And they can lose that desire to actually get into your presence if you're giving them really everything on their phone. So don't waste too much time texting and DMing and sexting with someone that you're interested in. You want to do that a little bit. But if you're interested in being with them for real, dating them, fucking them for real, in real life, in real time, get with them. Fast fashion is dying, and good riddance. Clothes should be well-made, good-looking, durable, and the people who make them should be treated well. That is why I am delighted to have Everlane as a sponsor of this show. Everlane started with a basic t-shirt and a simple but bold idea that they could set a new standard for the retail industry. Everlane makes beautiful, long-lasting products, so they only use high-quality materials, and they are trend, like me, they are trend-averse. They are not a fast fashion brand that leads to a lot of waste in the retail industry. Instead, they are focused on making classic clothing that can be worn year after year. Everlane only works with ethical factories, too, constantly vetting and evaluating factors like fair wages and safety. They're also environmentally conscious. For example, their denim factory, unlike most manufacturers that produce tons of waste, they recycle 98% of their water waste, repurposing byproduct and sending it off to a local brick factory, which then gets used to build affordable housing. Everlane reveals how much each item costs, from materials to labor to transportation, and what their markup is. Unlike other retailers, Everlane believes their customers have a right to know how much their clothes actually cost to make. Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. Their new soft wool sweaters look great. And their new line of clothing made from recycled plastic, yes, recycled plastic, is fantastic. Right now, you can check out my personalized collection at everlane.com/savage. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/savage, everlane.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 22-year-old cisgender straight male, and I had a quick question for you about the legal risks of engaging in light BDSM and spanking play. Recently, in a set of circumstances that are an entire other issue, I gave my parents access to a set of text messages between me and someone I was potentially going to be hooking up with. In the text, me and this girl were, in my opinion, flirting, talking about her not believing that I was, in fact, kinky, her saying that she likes it rough, and me indicating that I was into some kink play. My dad says that these kinds of texts, as well as this kind of play, or rather this kink play, could lead to a false claim or a claim in general of me assaulting someone, and that in addition, the texts themselves could be used as evidence against me. I was wondering if you had any experience or guidelines for someone beginning to explore this kink play, and also a response for when my parents ask me why I get pleasure from beating up girls, even though this is not my actual kink, and also say that this kind of behavior could land me in jail. As a side note, I am attempting to move out, but financially, that's not possible.
You just need to tell your parents to butt out of your private life. You're a 22-year-old adult, and adults sometimes engage in rough sex, in BDSM, in light spanking, and it's none of their business. And if you really feel like you have to get into it, if your dad insists on having this conversation with you about your legal liabilities, tell him it is better for you to have this negotiation over text, where there's proof that this was mutually consented to and mutually desired sex play, and you didn't just suddenly start spanking some girl in the middle of sex. If you wind up in bed with some sociopath who wants to be spanked but then is going to run to the police and show them your handprint on her ass and get you arrested and prosecuted for assault, You'll want to have those texts. Having those texts where you're flirting and bantering about the sex play, where you're negotiating about the consensual sex that you would like to have with this person that involves some rough play, is going to get you sprung. You're going to be able to produce that at trial very dramatically. Your lawyer can throw it on the table and you will be exonerated and your parents will not have to worry. And there are lots of books about BDSM out there. There are lots of articles that you can send your parents about BDSM. Google, find a few, send them to them. Tell them that you don't want to discuss this with them. But if they're curious about why some people are turned on by these things, they should do a little bit of reading. But what they're not going to do anymore is speak with you about it. This is your private life. These are your private sexual interests and encounters, and they are none of your parents' business. Period. Who's sleeping in your bed? All right. None of my business, unless you call the show, in which case it becomes my business. But I can tell you this. You want the people sleeping and doing other things in your bed to be as comfortable as possible, to want to come back to your bed as often as they're invited, which is why you want Bull and Branch sheets. Everything Bull and Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means their products start out super soft and get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Bull and Branch sheets are only a couple of $100. Everyone who tries Bull and Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands and thousands of five-star reviews. Bull and Branch only uses sustainable and responsible methods of sourcing and manufacturing, and they donate a portion of every sale to a charity that helps fight human trafficking while preserving fair prices for consumers. And new sheets are arguably the best gift imaginable. Wouldn't you want someone you sleep with to give you new, beautiful sheets? So do it for them and for yourself, for those nights that you sleep over at their place. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, you can send them back for a refund, but I doubt that you'll want to send them back. Still, there is no risk, therefore no reason not to give Bull and Branch a try. To get started, right now my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com when you use the promo code SAVAGE. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code SAVAGE. bollandbranch.com, promo code SAVAGE.
Hi, Dan. I'm a mid-20s female living in the South right now, and my question is about my boss. I work just for a guy. I'm an independent contractor. I do archival work on this guy's computer, and I use his computer regularly, and he keeps leaving porn out, and I keep finding it on his computer. I'm like kind of hysterical right now because I just opened our shared Evernote, and there's a list of like amateur teen porn links from X-Hamster saved onto our Evernote. He's such a dumbass, and I think I'm going to quit my job anyway, but I'm wondering if it's my responsibility to have a conversation with him about this. I don't think he's leaving it up there for me to find intentionally because he gets off on it or anything. I really just think he knows enough about technology to find the porn and save it somewhere, but not enough about technology to hide it from me. I've also found, like, I've opened up his internet browser with him looking over my shoulder on my first day of work. And there is just like a giant cock on the screen. And I kind of ignored it because I was just so flabbergasted. We both just kind of ignored it. But now I'm kind of at the point where I'm thinking I'm going to quit anyway. And I'm wondering if it's my responsibility to have a conversation with him about this.
You're giving him the benefit of a doubt that I wouldn't necessarily be inclined to give him, and that others certainly wouldn't be inclined to give him. That all of this porn that he's leaving strewn about for you to find, including for you to find while he's looking over your shoulder, that he's doing all of these things by accident. Once can be regarded as a misfortune. Twice looks like carelessness. Three or four times looks intentional. That's what I would say to him if I were you. Look, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt. Another employee, your next employee, because here's my letter of resignation, I'm putting my 2 weeks in, might sue you. I could sue you. What you're doing legally is called creating a hostile work environment. And I don't think you did it on purpose. I'm giving you the benefit of that doubt. Your next employee, though, might call a lawyer, not just get her resume out there and find a new job, which is what I decided to do, in part because I was sick of looking at giant cocks on your computer screen and having to see when I'm doing the job that you hired me to do, having to look into your dick. The things that turn you on, the things that make your dick hard, are not things that I, as your employee, should know about or be forced to contemplate. And your carelessness has forced me to contemplate that. And I regard it, you could say to him, as carelessness. Your next employee might not be so understanding, indulgent, might not be so willing to give you the benefit of the doubt that I've given you. So, dude, you want some advice? Get a separate computer that you only use for porn. You own this company. You can fucking afford it. That extra computer, that other computer that is your fun time computer, is going to be a lot less expensive at the end of the day than the lawsuit that's coming your way from your next employee if you keep this shit up.
Hi, Dan. I am a cis woman, heteroflexible, living in the Midwest and married to a cis man who is a heterosexual. I have a question today about blowjobs in the context of my relationship. So my husband cannot come from oral, and he is the first man I've ever encountered who can't. But that's okay, and he still enjoys it. I really enjoy it. I enjoy giving it and getting it, but honestly, I enjoy giving it even more. I've always been into this. We met in the BDSM scene. I am always the sub. He's always the top. So I really like giving head as a way of servicing my top. So here's the issue. He says he still enjoys getting head from me, even though it can't make him come. But the problem is, when I'm giving him head, he just lays there silently with his eyes closed. He doesn't really interact with me at all. And this makes me feel like I'm not doing a good job or he doesn't like it. And the problem is, I have talked to him about this. I've brought it up and told him, you know, if you could just, like, you know, feel me up or tell me I'm doing a good job or, you know, tell me it feels good, make a little sound, anything to interact with me, that would be great. And he adjusted and was a little more handsy during and made some noises. But over time, over the last couple months, he sort of reverted back to his, like, zombie blowjob default, where he just lays there, doesn't say anything, doesn't make any sounds, eyes closed. And it just makes me feel like shit. I am enthusiastic about giving head. I've had lots of previous partners sing my praises about how good I am at it. So I'm just wondering, how do I revisit this with him in a way that will stick? Because we've had this conversation more than once, and he will, you know, be better for a while, interact with me more, and then he'll revert back. I should mention this is only related to giving head. When we have sex, he's very interactive. He talks dirty. He, you know, makes me feel like he's interested in what we're doing and engaged in it. It's just this one sex act that he seems to completely zone out of and just disappear on me on. So, Dan, what do you think? How do I revisit this with him in a way that it's going to stick? Or do we have a bigger conversation about if this is something he actually wants?
Two suggestions. First, you can have this convo while you're giving him head. If it's feedback you want, you can take his dick out of your mouth for just a minute, keep your hand working his cock, and say, do you like that? How's that feel? Are you enjoying this? I love sucking your dick. And you can ask him a question that requires him to respond, and maybe that'll shake him out of zombie mode. I have an idea, though. I have a theory. I have a hunch that the reason he clamps his eyes shut and lays very still is that oral isn't something that he enjoys. Those guys are out there. Now, some guys can't come from oral alone, and they are no more damaged than women who can't come from vaginal penetration alone. Oral is always portrayed in films and television, as in porn, as some sort of magic formula. Dick, ad, mouth, instantaneous orgasm. Not always the case. That's why they're called blowjobs. They're a lot of work. And they don't work for everybody. And guys who can't come from oral sex, they feel like they're damaged or broken somehow. And the women that they're with, or the guys that they're with, will write me wondering what's wrong with them. And a lot of people who have partners, male partners who can't come, or penis-having partners who can't come from oral alone, will regard them as damaged or defective or wonder what they're doing wrong, or will get into some insecurity spiral about it instead of just accepting that this isn't a thing that works for everybody. Works for most, not for all. In addition to those guys, there are guys out there who just don't like it, who've tried it and just don't care for it. It's not their favorite thing. Your husband might be one of those guys. And I think you need to have a conversation about him where you just put that on the table. If you don't like having your dick sucked, then that's okay. And I think you might want to just toss that on the table. You might want to ask him if he just doesn't like blowjobs. And the reason I have a hunch that that might be it is if he's laying back and closing his eyes and going zombie on you, he may be fantasizing about whatever he needs to fantasize about at that moment to keep his dick hard while you guys are doing this thing that you enjoy very much and he would like to do with you, allow you to do to him because you take so much pleasure in it, but it's not working for him. It doesn't work for him. And so he has to zone out. He has to leave the room. He has to fantasize about the things that do work for him so that his dick in your mouth stays hard. Because if he engages, he might lose his erection. And then what are you going to think? And what are you going to ask that Dan Savage faggot when you call a show about this problem? So put those both on the table. If you say, look, if you don't like blowjobs, can you just tell me that? And it's nice that I like them. And so you're allowing for me to do it. And if you're taking pleasure in my pleasure, I appreciate that. That's sometimes the give and take of a long-term committed sexual relationship where we're both attempting to meet each other's needs. And that's legitimate. And if that's not the issue, if you press him on that and that's not it, and it's just, this is how he likes to receive a blowjob with his eyes clamped shut, but that's not how you like to give a blowjob, then don't just talk to him about the blowjobs once in a while. Talk to him about the blowjobs during the blowjobs. You can force him to engage. You can force him to be present if indeed he's enjoying these blowjobs. But I hear you. I feel your pain. A few months ago in Savage Love, I asked somebody if the person they were with was good at getting blowjobs. We always talk about whether someone's good at giving head. There are people out there who are really bad at getting head. They may even be enjoying it, but they don't give you any feedback. They lay there with their eyes shut like a zombie. They're very still. And to be someone who's giving a blowjob, you're doing a lot of work and a little encouragement and feedback and being able to perceive that you're giving this person pleasure is inspiring. It's rewarding. It makes the blowjob fun for you too. And it makes you feel some power, actually. You know, a lot of people think giving a blowjob is very submissive, but you've got this person's dick in your mouth. They're really helpless. And if you are causing them to experience all these waves of pleasure, that is an expression in a way of power and control that can balance those feelings of submission that for some people kind of make blowjobs feel a little bit uncomfortable. So not getting that kind of feedback, being with someone who's terrible at getting a blowjob, can be very dispiriting. So I feel your pain. Sounds like he's terrible at getting blowjobs. Ask him questions. Ask for feedback while you're giving him blowjobs. Maybe he'll get less bad at it over time. But if he just doesn't like head, and some guys don't, there's no fix for that.
Hey, Dan. So I'm calling for my sister, actually. And she confided in me the other day that she was a victim of sexual assault. Here's what happened. She met a guy on Tinder. They went out to their first date. She went to go get drinks with the guy. Things were normal. She said that she had only 3 drinks and that she noticed she started stumbling around. And the guy took note of this and had said, you know, you're stumbling, you're fumbling. Come home to my place, have some water, and then go home. I don't want you going straight home. And she said, that sounds great. She's not usually a stumbler after 3 drinks, so looking back on this, she thinks that she might have been roofied. So she goes back to his place. They're sitting there. He asks to kiss her. Things are going well, and she's like, yeah, you seem like a nice guy. Why not? Kiss me. And then she told me before she knew it, the guy had ripped off her clothes. He was down to his boxers, and luckily she had enough awareness and strength in her to get the fuck out of there. And apparently in the moment, the guy was denying it, saying that he didn't do anything. He didn't know what was going on. He texted her the next day and was like, that didn't happen. So really trying to gaslight her. So, you know, she told me about this event 2 days after the fact. And it wasn't rape. It was assault. She thinks she was drugged, isn't totally sure. What can she do besides block the guy? Like, do you file a police report?
Do you just not get drinks with people anymore for fear of getting drugged? What do we do? What should I tell her to do?
If she thinks this guy might have roofied her, and Occam's razor here kind of sounds like he roofied her. There was an instance once I read about years ago where a woman was at a bar with a man and somebody else put a drug in her drink, hoping to scoop her up. And the guy that she was with was initially the suspect. And it turned out that there was this other dude who did it. But Occam's razor, yeah, that's incredibly unlikely. That is such an outlier, that one woman's experience of being roofied by not the guy that she was on the date with. This guy sounds like, for sure, he roofied her. Too late for a toxicology test, most likely, but not too late to file a police report, even if she just suspects. There could be a pattern here. If two or three other women have filed reports about this guy, if this guy is a sex offender who has recently been released after being prosecuted for having done this exact thing to someone else, she could return a very dangerous sexual predator to prison where he belongs. So for that reason alone, I would encourage your sister to file that police report. Someone who roofies a person has probably roofied other persons. There's always that first time, that magical first time a sexual predator, some piece of shit asshole roofies someone. But in most cases, somebody who's roofied someone has roofied someone before. There could be three or four other police reports out there. Your sister filing an additional report may cause them to act. There may be just one other report out there. But a second may cause them to act, to have probable cause, to get a warrant, to search his apartment, to find the drugs, if indeed he has the drugs in his apartment. And then he could wind up in jail where he belongs. So from me to your sister, please relay this, my encouragement for her to file that report. And now your tweets. Babylon Leather tweets, listening to an old episode of the Savage Lovecast where you, Dan, were looking for that feeling after good sex and you said afterglow. We call that hashtag fuck drunk in our playgroup here, and it caught on with another local sex podcast, and I think it's going to catch on with mine now. Thank you, Babylon Leather. Andrew tweets, I am some weeks behind, but I have listened to every episode of the Savage Lovecast, and I think Stormy Daniels gave by far the most thoughtful advice of any guest ever. We have some Stormy Daniels news coming up soon in the new year that I'm very excited to share as soon as we have nailed it down. You'll all hear about it here first on the Savage Lovecast. And Carrie Pollock tweets, regarding the woman in episode 634 who was 75 years old and desperately horny, you suggested that she look for a man her age or older. Why not younger? She said she feels like she's 57. Maybe she can expand her search. Some men dig older women. Very good point, Carrie. Very good catch. Thank you for writing in. If you want me to read one of your tweets on a future episode of the Savage Lovecast, be sure to include the hashtag Savage Lovecast. And now your response calls.
Hi, Dan, Nancy, and the tech savvy at Risk Youth. I'm calling in regards to episode 636, your advice about the guy who is in love with his female best friend who is not interested. And there's one piece of information, one detail that I think you glossed over, Dan. They're spending a lot of their time slow dancing together and learning love songs together and doing a whole bunch of romantic activities. And while ending the friendship may be the right course of action, it could just be that not doing romantic stuff together will stop his romantic feelings for her. So maybe he suggests, instead of we can't be friends anymore, that we stop doing these slow dances and love songs together and instead go to movies or go get dinner with groups or go play mini golf or things that are not quite so romantic and not quite so date feeling. And maybe some of his feelings will subside because maybe they're just coming from what they're doing instead of just the fact of their relationship.
I'm calling in regard to the person who had a problem with her vibrators both dying and trying to figure out how to recycle them. The issue in both circumstances is the battery. They're an environmental nightmare. That's the thing that you need to recycle the most. That's also why it's dying. Same reason your iPhone dies after 2 or 3 years, vibrators die. Battery technology is not where it needs to be. And even the most expensive vibrator is going to die after about that time, 2-3 years max. The best thing to do is, my opinion, since you might want to throw the thing in a landfill, is to take it apart, at least pull out the battery, pull out the motor. You could throw those into a recycling bin that recycles batteries and be a lot more environmentally conscious that way. Throwing it in a landfill, terrible idea. That battery is the worst part of it. That's the thing you do not want to just throw in the trash.
Hi, Dan. I'm calling in response to episode 636, and the sister who was having the awkward conversation with her teenage brother on his potential threesome. I did want to share an experience I had in college many years ago. It was spring break my junior year, and I had my first threesome with two friends. Being at a small liberal arts college and being a little braggadocious, I confided in some of my close friends and gained that social capital that you referenced in regards to your brother. What I hadn't considered at the time was how my social capital came at the expense of slut-shaming my two female friends that had invited me into that threesome. I definitely was not mature enough at the age of 21 for my first threesome and feel that your brother is in the same position. As a older female role model to your brother, you have a unique opportunity to teach your brother how to view things through the eyes of a female. And I think that you should also use this opportunity to talk to your brother about things like consent and slut shaming and the topics that you wish that guys that you had seen maybe would have reflected on your experiences with them. Thanks, Dan, and thanks, caller. Keep up the great work.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you'd like to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian. And me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thank you for downloading.